Welcome to the dialogue series, Dancing in the Liminal, a global border-crossing inquiry into art, activism, spirituality, and leadership of the 21st century. I'm your dialogue hostess, Vanessa Fisher, and I'm here with my guest, Benita Roy. Benita is an award-winning process philosopher whose work on consciousness has been twice awarded for academic achievement at international conferences. She's also the founder and curator of the Magellan Courses, an online experimental course in post-conventional learning. Benita lives on a farm with her partner in Northwest Connecticut, where they host facilitated workshops focused on energy awareness, body language, emotional balance, and transformative inquiry. January, Benita is going to be offering a course called Dancing with the Shadow. And for those of you who follow a lot of my work in writing, this is a topic I've always held a deep interest and fascination for. And I've written a whole trilogy series on the dark side of the sacred and done interviews around the shadow in relation to sex and art and madness and mysticism. And I invited Benita to do this talk with me because I find that she has a very expansive mind and holds a very unique kind of meta perspective as a philosopher, but also an interest in the practical applications of that meta perspective on shadow in everyday life and in collectives as well. So we both have a deep mutual interest in the topic. We agree on a lot of things. We disagree on some things. So I thought it'd be fun to do a dialogue and just kind of see where it took both of us in the inquiry. So it's a real honor to have you, Benita, and thanks for being on my dialogue series.
Great. Thank you. You know, Vanessa, I'm a real admirer of your own work, so it's a real pleasure to be able to collaborate with you a little bit here. And I'm looking forward to see what we can dig up in this conversation.
So the first thing I wanted to do, you have your own framing you've been building around how you're understanding the shadow. You're building this sort of meta framing, you could say, based on your understanding of Carl Jung's work and how he was informed by shamanism, as well as your own ideas and philosophy. And I thought we could just start by giving people a larger meta framing for how you see the shadow. It's going to be a little more theoretical to start, just so people know, and then we're going to try to bring it down piece by piece into experience and different ideas. So maybe if you just want to start with that, and then we can dialogue as we go.
Sure. Well, first, in terms of the larger context of my own work, the Shadow Course is part of the Magellan Fellowship Initiative, and the tagline there says, original views on timeless ideas. And briefly, what I'm trying to do is take themes that have been important and significant and consequential for a long period of time, but that have been primarily constructed in terms of structural polarities. So, for example, we have the shadow versus the self. It's a little bit of an oversimplification, but these themes oftentimes have come to us in the modern world structured in a kind of reductive way. So instead of just dealing with the concept of shadow as shadow versus self, what I'm trying to do is take themes like this and extend them into a wider constellation or a larger systemic context. So in the case with the shadow, when I extend this into more of a system-wide framework of how the self system works, or what I call the system of self-states, then it turns out that we can appreciate more of the genius in the system. And in the process, I've been able to integrate Jungian psychology, shamanism, and some really deep esoteric Buddhist practice. So it's really exciting stuff. And I'm finding that if people are honest about doing the work, then they can really receive a lot of benefit from opening the conversation into a more systemic constellation. So that's the larger context of my own work.
One thing you said that I found interesting was that, you know, modern kind of understandings of shadow tend to be conceptualized within this dialectic. So you said self and shadow. And I think many people would say that shadow is part of the self and they're integrated in some form. But I do agree with you in the sense that we tend to kind of, when we think about it or conceptualize, we sort of see these dualisms or polarities.
Exactly. I think the sophisticated person would articulate it the way you have, that the shadow and the self obviously are integrated. And yet, we don't necessarily have convenient tools to see how that works. And so this is the process of coming up with these other tools to really understand, well, what does integration mean, or why do we have a self in a shadow in the first place? Is it just some horrible part of the human condition? It turns out it's not a horrible part of the human condition. It's actually a very beneficial system once we see it in its larger context. So do you want to
go into a little bit of that? Like, how do you see the shadow emerging? And I mean, you have a very big frame within which you're looking at it. So I'd love to hear some of the ways you're thinking about that.
Yes. So how do we get from here to there? Well, you know, basically the shadow, as conventionally understood, is a psychodynamic where we repress, suppress, or refuse some aspects of ourselves and project that as an object either into another person or frequently into the way the system works. And in a sense, we become a victim to something which is actually rejected in ourselves. So, for example, I frequently come across people who are at the top of their game, let's say in an organizational setting, and they complain a lot that there's nobody around that has the capacity to help them. There's a lot of dysfunction around them. They are very frustrated by this. And when you actually work with these people, you find that because they have a very high skill set, and they are very capable people, they're actually kind of control freaks. And so they hire apprentices, and they don't give the apprentices a chance actually to learn the job and take over from them. They kind of short-circle the cycle and control over them everything themselves and end up fighting against an illusory problem. And the problem's not dysfunctional people around them, but this inability for them to understand that they are always in control, that they have a very large capacity to control things, and in that sense, in understanding that, they can relax. And this is an important distinction to make, because we want to make the distinction between unconscious content, so content in the subjective landscape that we are not aware of, and the cycle, which is dysfunctional. So it's the repression and projection cycle, which is dysfunctional, but not the shadow content itself. And this is, I think, an important distinction. And the way to find the gift or the treasure in the shadow is to understand that the content itself is multiple and rich and part of the human condition. It's your relationship or how you repress or project it that becomes the problem.
You were saying the content is different from the cycle it gets into. How do you frame or understand or just hold your understanding of the content and what the potential is in it and how it could be actualized potentially in a different way? What's your sort of sense of that?
Yeah, this is a personal question for me, because the shadow work I have done was sticky exactly around this problem. It was relatively easy for me to see my patterns, relatively easy for me to understand that I was caught in a cycle that wasn't productive. And I was being coached that inside this there's a genius, that you have to find the gift in the shadow. But it wasn't well explained to me. I kept on thinking that I had to find something that was antithetical to what I was doing or the opposite of what I was doing. And so, to answer your question,
that would be a result of that polarity, like thinking.
Exactly. And I kept on trying to figure out, well, you know, I'm aggressive, I should be more passive. Or, you know, I kept on putting it in terms of the opposite, and it was subtly presented that way. And so this is really where my project comes from, because if we could understand what the self system is, then the approach and the practices that we work with will enable us not to get stuck in this aspect. And, you know, it's interesting, because when you study Jung, you find out that he never really resolved this himself. He was in the process of working through a lot of his own shadow or problems during his lifetime. And so, you know, he calls this unconscious material, this part of your subjective landscape, he calls it shadow. Even that, the nuance, is somewhat worrisome or something. A shaman would never call the content in your dream world or your deep subjective landscape shadow. I mean, they would call it like the fountain, you know. So even
you think that was a product of Jung's own time and his sense of making things into polarities?
Well, yes, and also still being somewhat unsure of what the shadow is. Still it's nuanced in a kind of a worried or problematic way.
Right.
There's still something a little bit rejected about it. And if we can break through even that very subtle judgment of what this unconscious subjective material is, then I think we will not only be able to allow it to flow and be generative. I mean, Jung did say that the shadow material was the seat of creativity. So I'm not saying that he didn't recognize some of this, but in general, it's approached as something that is problematic or worrisome. We make an automatic judgment even as we say there's a genius in it. And this is a very important part, I think, of the new way of working with shadows, to really get beyond this worrisome and to be gentle with yourself and to be curious, really curious about what is it in my deep subjective content that I'm not aware of, and have that kind of relationship with the work.
It's interesting that you're saying that, because I think in general we're really afraid of the unknown, right? So, I mean, it makes sense that we kind of put a negative connotation or a sense of worry around, just like even when you said, like, to the things that we don't know in our subjective landscape. Like, I think it scares a lot of people to even think that there's things that we're not aware of that, you know, we're transmitting all the time. So it seems like getting over that hump of the way that we conceptualize it, the way that we feel about it, also has something to do with making a new relationship with the unknown in general.
Exactly. And so the ramifications of that can be huge. And we talked a little bit about the conventional understanding of a shadow and projecting some of these personality aspects onto other people. What some of the distinctions Jung made was, for example, he called this part of the subjective content the unconscious. And so at the cultural level, there's aspects of yourself that are collectively unconscious inside your culture. You know, above that, there's aspects of yourself that are unconscious to you as a person. And to be able to work with that material, you need at least one other person. And then within the next layer of unconscious material is the collective unconscious, the cultural collective. So you cannot process the cultural blind spots within your own culture. That's why they're called unconscious, collective to that culture. And Jung, he didn't spend a lot of time looking at cultural complexes. It's actually quite a new area of research, but he did make that distinction. What becomes really fascinating to me in terms of integrating Jung with shamanism is the next level of collective unconscious, and it's the level of archetypes. And what Jung said was, you know, it's our collective unconscious, and the collective in this sense means all human beings. So this becomes very fascinating, because if it's collectively unconscious to all humans, then how do we access this deeper subjective content? In Jungian fashion, this is accessible through dreams, and the not so much in Jung's system, the reinterpretation of dreams, but the reliving, the living presencing of dreams.
This is for archetypal material?
For archetypal material. But for shamans, there's a whole different type of understanding of the level of archetypal materials. And for shamans, archetypal material is the part of our subjective content that is our animal nature. Mm. And so, for example, Jung noticed that archetypal material often has animal symbols. He called them living symbols, like the horse, the snake, the eagle, wolf, or deer, or imaginal human-animal combinations like the centaur. So the level of archetype has something to do with this deep layer of almost, we could say, animal consciousness in us. And so for me, where those two meet, Jung moving down underneath the collective unconscious into the archetypes, and the shamans working with animals and animal nature is where the integration of the two frames comes into play. And actually, Jung wrote about this late in his life. I'm just going to read this quote. He said, "The deeper layers of the psyche lose their individual uniqueness as they retreat farther and farther into the darkness. Here they become increasingly collective until they are universalized, merging with the body's instinctual and biological functions, and eventually with nature itself. Hence, at bottom, the psyche is simply world." So he intuited that the collective unconscious goes all the way down into the biological and the instinctual, and then actually into the physical world. And this is truly the domain of shamanism.
And I'd like to kind of go into your sense of the integration of these different frames. And maybe, I mean, however you want to kind of go into that, but like I'd like to ask like how you see traditional forms of psychodynamic work now addressing issues of shadow, and then these more shamanistic traditions and how they address shadow, how they might complement each other, how they're working on different layers, or if you wanted to kind of talk about any of that, that might help with just framing it.
Yeah, the good news is that the cycle of the shadow effect, the repression and projection, is iterative. So when you do conventional shadow work and you learn, you start to see how it works. You start to see that you're enacting or acting out something inside of you that's creating patterns. And then you start to realize that the first step in recognizing what you can't see is to find the origin of this. So I may be acting out being a victim all the time, but the origin is actually a relationship I had with my father when I was growing up. So finding the origin of the dysfunction or the pattern that keeps on repeating in this shadow effect process is iterative. It's the same thing at different levels. So in cultural shadow work, as a culture, you begin to see relative to other cultures that you're not exercising the sum total of human condition. You've only adopted a victim stance or an aggressive stance or some archetypal relationship with other cultures. Right. And the first step is to find the origin of that, to understand it at its origin. So that would be conventional therapeutic work. And it would be, in a sense, the same at the deeper levels. And so to give you an example, if we think, this is kind of a big step, but if we think about the situation we are in with our environment, and climate change and habitat loss and toxins in our environment, there's a real question of whether or not this is because as a species we haven't really looked at our deeper animal nature, and beneath that, you know, our nature inside the biological world, in the physical world itself, and really understand that we are a multiplicity of subjective content. And so it's one of my hypotheses, or I begin to suspect that we can't really solve some of these problems with the environment until we actually do shadow work at the level between the human and something that's much more ancestral to us. So that would be integrating conventional shadow work that works at the either personal or collective level with moving into the deeper levels of subjective content in this framework and moving into more shamanistic types of practices.
This is an interesting point. I kind of want to play something with you with this because it brought up something, a question I've been playing with a lot around. I mean, you and I are very embedded in conversations around evolution and the evolution of consciousness and, you know, whether it's integral discourse or your work with post-conventional learning. And I think one of the things I've always been really fascinated with is there's been this tension point in understanding evolution that sort of, you know, these next steps we need to take are kind of pushing into the future, you know, like these higher capacities, these really need to move forward to be able to find the answers for the kind of problems where we've created on the planet, basically. And I think a lot of that, there's actually a big truth. You know, I think it was Einstein that said the world cannot solve the problems it's created with the level of consciousness that's created them. So there's a certain sense that we have to develop and create a larger frame with which to look at things. The interesting thing I find, I'm just curious to get your take, and as you're talking about shamanism and these lower layers, is that as we kind of develop, or as I've noticed in my own experience, as I develop, that there's this real sense that almost evolution and involution start to kind of enfold on each other, or I just have less of a linear sense of evolution, you know, like it. And this is interesting, too, because some of the evolutionary discourse will really talk about how, as long as we keep kind of moving upward, those lower capacities always stay with us. Like, we retain those lower levels as we move up. But what I find interesting is that I was talking with Elza Malouf, who worked in Lebanon and the Middle East, and she said that as we also move up, we lose touch with the lower. So she was talking about, like, in tribal consciousness, she grew up in a war zone, and you sort of develop this instinctual capacity to, you know when there's danger around, and, like, to be able to, like, it's just this capacity you gain in a certain kind of environment under a certain kind of consciousness. And as you develop more into the higher levels, modern times, etc., there's actually a loss of that intelligence. And so I thought this was interesting because it points somewhat to what you're saying, that I think there's sort of these processes that are going on at the same time, and evolution and involution and what's necessary to really, you know, move us forward is actually less linear, and it may require actually almost going back and retaining intelligences from lower levels, or I don't know. I'm just curious your sense of this, or if I'm making any sense to you on this.
Oh, no, you're making a lot of sense, and you're actually touching on a lot of the points that the framework is meant to integrate. And so I'll just talk around it a little and then kind of hone in on it. If, in my opinion, people really did shadow work at this collective unconscious, human collective unconscious, then we would come to some really basic realities. And for me, people kind of are playing kind of a funny game with evolution. So, for example, we tell the story of evolution. First, there were the fishes, and then, you know, the dinosaurs, and then the small animals, and then the apes, and then there was us. And then we end there. There's a complete blind spot. It's not like then there was the apes, and then there was us, and then there's what's going to come after us, and then after that. It's kind of like there's a cliff, and it just stops, right? This is the hidden assumption in the way humans talk about evolution. It all evolves until it's up, and then there's, like, you know, the jackpot, the jack-in-the-box comes out or something. So it's truly not evolutionary. It's a story of a purposeful development up to human beings. Mm-hmm. Now, other people will say, because now that humans are human, then culture evolves on top of humans now,
right,
in a different way. So that further shows you that there's an end game kind of understanding about evolution up to humans, hierarchies of forms, right? The second thing is that you brought up involution, and involution is a very important part of this, and I'm not sure that everyone out there heard of the word, but there's a lot of different connotations of it. But if you think about it this way, archaic man lived his animal nature, couldn't think about it, didn't reflect upon it, didn't have archetypes, because he was this animal nature. And so then as archaic man evolves into the mythic person, then what comes along with it becomes deeper, involuted, subjective content. So now we don't live the archetypes, they're involuted in our evolutionary history. And
right,
the way they're involuted in our evolutionary history is not like fossils that are somehow static back there, but they're part of our moment-to-moment arising,
mm-hmm,
so that our ideas are always on top of the archetypes, which are images, which are always on top of the affective, emotional, or energetic level. So every moment-to-moment arising comes through all these levels always. And that's why I'm saying that the fact that this content is there is not problematic. It makes our phenomenal expression multiple and rich.
Right.
It's when it becomes, you know, we avoid or suppress, it's the consequence of the fact that we are all this, that it becomes problematic.
And you could argue that a lot of that stuff that like goes further back into our evolutionary history, we lose further touch with as we evolve in a certain sense. So like if we're not continually kind of looping or cycling through, you know, developing awareness around these different parts, you could potentially argue that they actually become more unconscious. Would you agree with that?
I agree with that in the sense that it isn't present to us in the same way.
In the forefront of our awareness or,
correct.
Or how we're making meaning or how, like the ways that those different levels are actually shaping the way that we're thinking about our subjective experience now. You know?
Exactly. The way I like to say it is this. When I've done this practice in a couple of times in a small groups of people, one of the ways that I like to describe it is like this. If I'm doing a meditation into my animal nature, it's pretty easy for me to find it because your animal nature is between life and death. Okay, the shadow at the persona or ego level is the ego has to live or the roles have to be maintained. But at the animal level, you're dealing with really some primordial fears between life and death. And when you work with this level, you often find two things. You find that you have extraordinary power as an organism, and that can be frightening. And you're frightened all the time. That's a very, very fundamental expression of animal nature. If you think about animals, they need to survive, they need to live. It's a big part of our evolutionary history. And this is inside us. It's inside everyone. And we pretend it's not in many cases. So to really go there is very important. At the next deeper level, when you get down to the elementals and the energetic primes and to do shadow work, you start working with what traditionally are deep Buddhist meditation practices on being in nothing. Because at that level, we don't want to believe in the fundamental source or origin that's empty or void. And so if you think about the shadow effect, we're running away from this fundamental source that's empty or void. Then we're running away from these primal animal inheritance that we have. And then, you know, it's kind of like you don't want to be running away from all of these. You want to be understanding that they constitute a rich, multiple stream of subjective content in the human condition. And so the way we address that, the way I address it, is to say, when I access my animal nature, I feel this fear. But I don't have to completely integrate that because I am completed by the sum total of living beings on the planet. The sum total of life is completed by the sum total of life. When I get to the human level, I can see perhaps that I have blind spots. But if I allow myself to be curious and open to the sum total of human experience, then I realize I am completed by everyone else, including me. And so I start to get this very, very deep understanding of the genius of the self system that allows me to be part of these multiple streams that are always already whole. And this is when, to me, the true, really fun work begins.
Well, because it's almost like you stop acting out of a sense of deficit.
Exactly. Great phrase.
Deficit, yeah. And it's interesting, too, because it does tie in with the sense that most, you know, not all, definitely not all, but a lot of traditional psychotherapy or therapeutic work tends to focus at the level of persona and trying to kind of integrate this persona, which is all important level, but it really, you know, you're taking it onto, like, many different levels. And you're also not necessarily saying, we're going to integrate everything and become perfectly whole on our own as an individual, because that actually may not even really be possible nor necessarily needed for what you're talking about.
Exactly. And so the goal is to be curious and open, and that's why I've started calling it the dancing shadow, to really open this up into something that is more positive without sidestepping the need to interrupt the dysfunctional cycle,
right.
The shadow effect.
And take responsibility for yourself also.
Exactly.
Yeah. The framing you're making, we've talked a little bit about this, which might be a good place to start bringing it out a little more, is this kind of way that you're attempting to really reframe shadow into this inherently relational nature of the shadow. So, I mean, there's obviously, we're not the only people talking about this, but I do think there's an interesting emphasis in contemporary culture to look at, like, individual shadow. And, I mean, even if you just look at it on the level, I've written an article about this, of just, you know, the way we talk about projection and we talk about, you know, shadow, it tends to be like, that's yours, this is mine, and there's a real attempt to really, like, separate whose is whose. And I think that that is a valid enterprise on a certain level.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting, too, that it does make this kind of very individualized sense of where these things are coming from. And I think that that's interesting because I just think, you know, maybe that, you know, that's one level that's very important. And maybe, like, another level of it, I'm just feeling this out in the moment because it's from my own experience, is that whatever we're working with is also really interconnected with other people all the time. And you actually almost in a way can't extricate those things in that, like, that kind of really neat way that we sometimes think we can. So I'm just curious your views on that. Like, how do you see this reframing of shadow in this more relational way? Just how do you hold that? How do you think about that in your own work?
Yeah, I think that to go back to what we were talking about and then kind of move into this new question, this notion of a lot of what goes on in the therapeutic context or especially in its spiritual counterpart is this notion that you kind of suggested that we actually create more buried shadow material in some of these practices. Mm-hmm. And the sense of being oppressed by what we don't know versus open and curious. And so once you start to become open and curious, that moves you into this completely relational dynamic of understanding, you know, being able to enjoy the elements of human experience that are not captured by you. It no longer becomes a imperative to capture all this subjective content. You truly move into a transpersonally relational orientation. And in a sense, it's interesting because you no longer try to fit that inside your own personal existence. I mean, obviously, this manifestation of a person inside this slice of space-time that is me cannot fit the sum total of human experience, never mind the whole evolutionary experience. But it's available to me, and it informs my phenomena, my consciousness, all the time. And if I'm curious about that, then what is attempted to be achieved by conventional shadow work is part of that process also, without creating more and more buried shadow work, buried shadow material. So it's definitely relational, but it's relational not in the sense that I'm over here and I'm relating to you over there and we need some kind of transport system. It's more relational in a transpersonal sense that we're in this system together. So when you talk about shadow dancing with personas and trying to figure out is that my shadow or your projection, this becomes almost impossible to figure out even from an outside observer. But if you move into a transpersonal relational field, you realize that this content is arising in this relational field that you and I share, and let's look at it. Disembedded from blame or guilt or shame, it can become fun and a curiosity of, wow, that always comes up when you and I are together. Isn't that interesting? You know, there's a whole different orientation to it. And I have this story I like to tell when people ask me this question, because personas are very interesting because, again, there's this sense in which there's a negativity around personas. But if we could imagine someone being 100% clear, I'm not sure it's possible, but, you know, no shadow content, no projections, no expectations, they would still have to deal with persona. Because if you're a tree, you know, you imagine you being a tree and people are walking in the woods and people are projecting all kinds of things on you all the time,
right.
You know. So you would still have to deal with personas that are between you and the other person.
Right.
And this becomes a really fun way to look at what are personas, how do personas fit in this relational field in the self system.
And doing that on all different layers, like really exploring that at every different layer.
On all different layers. At the level of, you know, you were talking about how as we move on, some of this deeper ancestral material is less available to us. And so on the one hand, that's okay, right, because we started by saying even if it's unconscious to us, we can be comfortable with that. It's completing us. We can be curious about it, but we don't have to be oppressed by not knowing.
Right.
On the other hand, it may be the case that one of the repeated cycles that's problematic in our modern world is when we take deep, subtle levels of our subjective content and we conceptualize them, that can be very similar to projecting as an object in conceptual space. And now we have a problem, because if we conceptualize it and reify it in a way that it's disowned, like somehow we feel that because we've conceptualized nature, it is no longer part of us, then this is a classic shadow effect. You take something that is you and you objectify it, in this case, in conceptual space. So this is why I'm saying a movement into this direction, I think, is very, very important for any kind of work that needs to be done in terms of planetary consciousness and working on the environment. The little bit that I've done in the last year and a half opens up huge possibilities. It's at least seeing where we're actually at and no longer pretending conceptually.
What you just said really hit the piece I was kind of speaking about before when I was talking about this sense that there's these different intelligences that I sense also get lost along the way, also that we kind of bury them. And the way you framed it was exactly kind of what I meant, is not that they're always there, but we kind of reconceptualize them as we develop, right? So we
right.
kind of create this way that we understand them. And that's okay, but like you said, I think there's actually a need to get in touch with the intelligence itself, and I think that can become less and less available to us the more we reify it with a particular understanding or conceptualization.
Exactly, and we become fascinated with the concept out there in conceptual space, and it no longer points to anything anymore, no longer points to what's actually arising in us. One of the things that's exciting to me about this new framework is that we have a pretty good handle on, in many cases, understanding how shadow at the persona level can trigger us. We're starting to get a handle on the cultural level. And because it's kind of an iterative process, then we can kind of fast forward our work into some of these lower levels. And I think that's really exciting.
That is.
As I said before, to be curious about what is other than your experience, and to be available to this larger choice field. And also, I think, to be in a state of like gratitude that all these beings and all these elements are not only completing you, but they're kind of essential to your own path. You know, they're part of the foundation or the infrastructure of your own path in real time, you know, without an involutionary perspective, then everything is always in the past. You know, my ancestors are always in the past. Archaic man's always in the past. And so from a truly transpersonal view, there is no shadow. But from a personal perspective, there's always blind spots. There's always more part of the human condition to discover.
You know, when you hold this larger view of the kind of inherent wholeness of all things or the transpersonal perspective, it gives you the spaciousness in a way to work with those other levels where we're going to run up against shadow, not only in ourselves, but in cultures and political systems. But we have a different view on it that doesn't have to hold it as this inherently negative process, and maybe more space to actually even work with it or dance with it, as you say.
Exactly. And on a real personal level, I'm not sure we really answered the question too easily about how to find the gift in your shadow. And just to come back to maybe an example, is to use my own personal example, I have a very strong memory of sitting on the porch on the second floor of my grandmother's house where we used to live and watching my father and his brother shoot birds. And this was in the mid-50s. They weren't horrible about it. It was certainly acceptable behavior, range of behavior during that period. And my sister doesn't remember it. But I remember this so clearly, and I was about 4 years old. And this became shadow material for me, the hurt, the tremendous hurt I had. The idea about the gift of the shadow is this didn't bother my sister or my cousins that, you know, were a part of this. And so the point is that people talk about a soul print. So in my soul print was a certain sensitivity to the natural world, which is why this particular incident affected me in a certain way. And so this is why these traumas actually point to the gift of your soul print, because within the range of normal behavior, why was that such a big deal to me? Why was this incident and not that incident important in my life? This points to what your life's purpose is, because you come through into your life with this gift, this profound sensitivity or a profound sense of perfection or ambition or strength or vision. And to me, that's one of the easy ways, you know, to find the treasure or the gift in difficult shadow effects.
I really like that, because I think it really reframes the sense both of deficiency and a sense of victimization that can happen around shadow material or things that have happened to us, traumas. And it makes a lot of sense just from my own experience too, and that those things really shape what your gift is if you orient to it in that form.
Exactly.
We're out of our time, but I put your course up on the website so people can check it out if they're interested just to learn what is in the course. Do you want to just say a little bit about just basics of what you're going to be covering or what your kind of aim is for the course?
Sure. It's an 8-week course, and each week we'll have an introduction, and then each week we'll concentrate on, up until I think the 6th or 7th week, on one of the levels in the framework. And the way methodology in the course is first clarity. So we get clarity about making the distinctions between the levels at each level. Then we want to look at each level thoroughly. And then what we want to do is do some practices so that we can personalize our own experience. This is not a course where you learn the framework and then you learn what you're supposed to feel about it. We'll do some journaling and some drawing and some group process to really kind of enable us to present and express what's going on with ourselves at different levels of engagement, create a lot of insights. And I think this idea of creating insights is the goal of the course.
Cool. Well, it sounds very exciting and interesting. And yeah, I just hope we continue the dialogue. I always find our conversations very fascinating. So thank you for joining me, and I wish you well with all your work.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.